Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
USDA gave us a small surprise in today's numbers.
Rich Nelson is chief strategist at Allendale, looking at the latest World Ag supply-demand estimates and ethanol.
For the oil crop side, they added 50 million bushels, not just to exports, which we actually disagree with here at Allendale. They also added 50 million bushels to corn for ethanol, and that's okay given how we've had a very strong production pace, 6% over last year through April. The question and concern we have right now is that recent weeks, three of the past 4 weeks, have seen a pretty good drop from prior aggressive levels. So USDA is okay for right now on that ethanol side, but we would have suggested maybe need to hold that back for another month or two here.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
At the Ag on the Mall event taking place in Washington, D.C., I have with me Bill Hurley with AgCo. And first of all, Bill, tell us a bit about what you do for AgCo.
My name again is Bill Hurley, and I'm vice president with AgCo and run our global government affairs organization.
Well, tell us a little bit about this exhibit you've put out here on the mall. You've got a bunch of equipment, and I'm sure hoping we got some attendees show up here and ask you a lot of questions. What are you going to tell them?
Well, first, I think we're excited to be here, and even more excited the fact that this event is occurring. And, you know, it's titled as the Celebration of Modern Ag on the Mall. And it's supported and led by the Association of Equipment Manufacturers. I'm fortunate to be able to serve as the chair of the Ag Sector Board for AEM. And you look at this event, and it is really about the ag equipment industry, the advanced ag technology groups coming together in a very unique place, you know, here in Washington, D.C. I know the listeners can't see it. We're looking at the Washington Monument and the U.S. Capitol. But the real intent of it is to be able to bring the message of the innovation that is occurring in the ag industry today to Washington. You know, whether that's the policymakers, the legislators, the regulators, and help them to truly understand what ag technology is doing today in regards to reducing our farmers' environmental footprint and ultimately enabling us as an industry to feed the world in a sustainable manner.
Well, just looking around at the exhibits in three sections of the mall here, you've got a lot of companies that are involved.
Yes, we do. I believe we've got 25 or 28 equipment manufacturers, and then over 30 ag-related associations and trade groups that are here, again, coming together to deliver our message of ag innovation and what it enables us to do from a sustainability standpoint.
Well, let's talk about AgCo for a minute, and what we like to know what's new. What's kind of like latest products out on the market, that kind of thing.
Well, I think, you know, AgCo, it is a unique American success story. We're one of the largest OEM ag equipment manufacturers in the world. The only pure play ag, that's all we focus on. And we are 34 years old. And so we look at our growth, it's been exceptional. And today, as you look at all of the equipment on our lot, both, you know, from the traditional tractor and sprayer perspective, but it's really about the technology and the advanced solutions that are in all of these machines that, you know, are either focused on things like improved fuel economy, but also pesticide reduction, the ability to manage seeds with a planter by the individual seed. And so it's those types of things that we're exceptionally proud of and excited about. But you ask what's new, probably one of the biggest things is we were just able to complete a joint venture with Trimble. And so we've launched our new PTX organization, which includes the Trimble technology piece, but also our precision planting. And as we see that as just a true launching pad for us to continue to deliver more advanced ag technology solutions.
Well, it's great to see you here, Bill, and we are at the Ag on the Mall event that's taking place in Washington, D.C. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So that's where, you know, we start looking elsewhere.
Dr. A.J. Tarpoff is a Kansas State beef veterinarian looking at lameness in cattle. What if there's no swelling?
We always start in the foot. Now, once we see that animal walk, even if there's no swelling, we still need to start down low. There is a condition that we occasionally see in pasture cattle, not extremely, you know, common in pasture cattle, but we'll see it in feedlots and we'll see it in dairy cattle. But it's called strawberry foot rot. It's called digital dermatitis. It's called hairy heel warts. So some of you may have heard one or more of those conditions, but it all those fancy names refer to, it's a hairy heel wart is kind of what we think about it, but they walk on their tippy toes. They're almost three-legged lame. It's very painful. You go, it's like, oh my goodness, this animal might have a broken leg. They act so lame. But really, it's just a skin infection. They'll walk on their tippy toes on either a front leg or a back leg. And we start to look at that, you know, go up behind them and there'll be either these growth-like that looks like warts on the back of their heel bulbs of their foot, or it's even bright cherry red. That's where the strawberry foot rot comes from. But one thing that's different with that, it's infectious. We don't 100% know what causes it or how it happens. One thing we know for sure is we need topical therapy. If we treat with just injectable antibiotics like we do foot rot, there will be no recovery time, so that they don't get better with just an injection. They do need topical treatment, and you can work with your local veterinarian to have some of those treatments.
Though most of the time we look at lameness and think of foot rot, Tarpoff says it could be the result of something else.
No swelling in the foot, so we started low, doesn't have hairy heel. Then we start looking at the other joints. So we can have some different scenarios with either our breeding animals or our young calves. We start looking up further up the legs. We can see big swellings at either the big joints, right? The stifle or the hock of the back leg, or the carpus and the elbow or the shoulder of the front leg. So if we see swelling in some of those key locations, that may tell us that we have something going on with one of the joints, whether traumatic or infectious. So with our breeding animals, usually our bulls, right? Our bulls are athletes. So they're out there doing a job. But unfortunately, they can get some athletic injuries, one of which is called a torn cranial cruciate ligament. It's an ACL tear. Many folks, hear about ACL tears in football players. You know, if they cut a different way, well, think about a 2,000-pound bull that twists the wrong way while they're out there working. Guess what? They can actually rupture that ligament, and that can be very detrimental to them. That can end their breeding season. So again, if you see a big swollen stifle, it's up by the belly, that big knee joint in the back leg of a bull, you know, that could have been a traumatic injury. Now our calves, whether it's a weaned stocker animal or a, you know, young spring born animal, if we get those big joints that are swollen, we have to think septic arthritis. So for that weaned calf, some of the same bugs that cause pneumonia and cause lung infections, some of those pathogens can get into the bloodstream and seed into those joints, causing these nasty infections. So those big joints, we think they're bacterial caused in calves. For the young calf, it may have had not enough colostrum intake, and we could have had some septicemia is what we call it, bacteria going through the system, and they can seed into those joints, causing these big blown up joints, very lame. It takes a long time to recover from those. We can treat them systemically and get rid of some of the bacteria, so to speak, but it's going to be a long rest and recovery time for them to fully recover.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So for Brazil, even though it's Southern Hemisphere, this is the crop that is in the ground now, just about to be harvested.
Latest new crop cotton projections, Dr. Mark Jackanowski, Chairman, World Ag Outlook Board.
We are anticipating record production in Brazil based on a strong growth in area and good yields. I'll have a few charts here just to demonstrate that in a minute. Turkey up a bit. That's also an area increase. China down a little bit, but not in the main growing region in Xinjiang. Production expected to be relatively flat. So that's a decrease mainly in some of the more fringe areas of the country that also produce cotton, where it's just not as economical. India down a bit, lower prices, economics favoring some other higher value crops like pulses and whatnot. Just a quick couple of charts here on Brazil. So strong growth in Brazil cotton area. So for this crop year, so for the crop that's about to be harvested, area is forecast at a 50-year high, anticipating trend yields. So that is what is leading us to expect a record crop in Brazil. And what's the, one thing that, we have to say is partly behind this big expansion in the area is just the fact that strong demand from China. And you can see where it really started to, so this is Brazil cotton imports by China from the main sources. Brazil being the part of the graph here in green, you can see in 2018 where it really picked up. China started buying from Brazil, continues strong, and that's driving a lot of that area growth in Brazil.
Back at home, Mark Brown is Director of Field Services for Plains Cotton Growers.
There is no doubt that those planting dates do drive the decisions, and especially in our northernmost counties, because when you look at their overall heat unit accumulation on a long-term average and you look at that planting deadline, that is a very real deadline to meet for cotton production, because if you get very far past that deadline, then you just run out of heat unit accumulation potential. And so for most of our counties, actually, in the high plains, that planting deadline is May the 31st, and that's all those northwestern and northernmost counties all the way down to Bailey and Lamb counties. So they're looking at having to have all their cotton in the ground and in place by May 31st. And then we've got a June 5th deadline in that middle tier of counties, which would include Lubbock and Hale County, Floyd and Crosby, all the way down diagonally to Gaines County. And then finally, we've got a southernmost tier of counties in the Plains Cotton Growers region that has a June 10th planting deadline, such as where I'm at today down here in Midland and Martin counties, goes across to Andrews and all the way up to Lynn and Garza County. And so they have until June 10th and have a little bit more time for some moisture to fall and to be watching the moisture conditions in the topsoil and hopefully just plant one time and make this crop stick, especially because of the cost of inputs this year. I know that's a very real concern for producers. They don't want to have to get into a replant situation.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So the hybrid wheat tour is actually an event where many people involved in the wheat industry to some extent gather to go out and check wheat fields around Kansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma.
Kansas State Wheat Production Specialist Romolo Lolato on the Hard Red Winter Wheat Tour.
Try and come up with the size of the crop, right, and maybe some thoughts on also what the quality of that crop is going to be. And what's interesting also about this tour is that, as I mentioned, it's people from very, very differing backgrounds, right? So you may have here people from K-State like myself, a few growers participating in the tour as well, and they really enrich the experience too just by sharing what they're seeing. We may have bankers, we may have traders, we may have people in the milling industry, people in the baking industry. So it's a very, very diverse group that somehow everybody is related to wheat, right? You may have even Dunkin' Donuts traders participating on the tour. But they might not have seen a wheat field in their life before, right? And so many of these folks are the first time that they're visiting a wheat field. But they do work with wheat to some extent. And so they're interested in learning more. It's a very good educational opportunity for us to, get the word out about wheat grown in Kansas and in the southern plains here, and also a little bit of the culture, right? We do stop on many, many wheat fields, but we also stop at some cultural things that we might find along the way. So it's a very good exchange of knowledge and exchange of just having more context of people in the wheat industry.
So what can we expect as far as yields for this year's crop?
So in my car, we end up at 35 bushels per acre on measurements. Our eyeball estimate because we always, before calculating the yields, we do a little game and just say, okay, what's our eyeball estimate here? It was a little bit lower than that. We were thinking 30 is probably what our route could do, but I can see how we can do 35 if conditions are right. Now, for the entire tour yesterday, that we're looking at many more routes now, all the way from the one that went through Oklahoma, all the way until those in central Kansas. It turned out that 42 was the final estimate for the day yesterday. Can the crop make 42? Probably can if we have cool and moist conditions. However, if you're 10 days down the road, it becomes hot and dry, I don't know that it can get there. In terms of growth stage of the crop, whenever we left Kobe, the crop was just at that heading stage. And as we headed towards which that crop progressed to maturity, and some pursuits that we did later in the day, they were reaching the soft dough stage. And so talking to some growers about the expected harvest date, they believe at this point in time, their crop is about 7 to 10 days ahead of schedule. And some growers in Summer County that I touched base with, they mentioned probably 1st of June, there will be somebody harvesting in Summer County already, which is quite a bit early. So the crop is ahead of schedule. That can be good in terms of perhaps avoiding some heat stress later on, right? So I guess fingers crossed the weather conditions, they are cool and moist, the grain feeling, so that we can actually have a decent crop. If it turns dry here pretty soon and hot, or drier, I should say, and grain field turns out to be dry and hot, those fields that have already a very stressed potential, they could go downhill pretty quickly.
And this is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We have seen a little bit of weakness in pork exports.
Dr. Mark Jackanowski is chairman of the World Ag Outlook Board, looking at the latest WASD report and the global balance sheet.
Again, as I mentioned, strong dollar, a lot of competition from other exporters, and a little bit less demand from Mexico and others as well. Moving into 2025, tighter U.S. supplies of beef expected to cut into U.S. beef exports to some degree, as you can see. Pork exports up on the other hand, higher production, demand recovery, and lower prices supporting higher U.S. pork exports. And same with broilers as well. Beef imports also next year expected to be relatively strong, reflecting tight U.S. Beef supplies. Let's wrap things up here with dairy. Milk production up this month for 2024 and anticipated to grow into 2025 as well. Both stronger milk per cow and cow numbers driving both of those increases. And then in terms of dairy product trade, for 2024, the main story here, and this is a similar story to last month, strong butter and cheese demand and prices, bringing in more imports of butter and cheese and undermining exports of butter and cheese. So on the other hand, for the dry products, relatively weaker demand for non-fat dry and whey. Export possibilities there. Moving into 2025, import fat basis imports, so cheese and butter, high U.S. production should reduce the demand for imports to some degree and relatively high international prices as well. Exports, on the other hand, focusing on skim solids, some strength there, relatively lower U.S. prices for dry products such as whey and non-fat dry. Speaking of prices, dairy product prices, cheese prices, we've been seeing a lot of strength just recently in the past few weeks, so that's reflected here. Good demand for cheese driving prices higher for 2024, so we raised that price. Also continued strong demand for butter to price strength there. As I noted, not quite as much demand strength for the dry products, non-fat, dry, and dry whey, seeing some price weaknesses there. Moving into 2025, relatively lower prices across the board, just reflecting higher supplies of milk production itself and all of the products. So real quick on the class prices. So for 2024, class three prices higher. That is reflecting those the strength in the cheese prices. For class four, it's lower non-fat dry milk that more than offsets stronger butter prices, and the all milk price up 30 cents per hundredweight to $21.20. Next year, we anticipate that to be about 30 cents lower, $20.90.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We finally do have final numbers by state and for the U.S. crop.
Mark Brown is Director of Field Services with Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Growers on final production numbers from 2023.
And so when we look at that 2023-24 cotton crop, which is last year's crop, of course, the final estimates that just recently came in and were recorded, and I got this from the Economic Review with National Cotton Council, and I was reviewing those numbers. So the U.S. produced 12.07 million bales as of last year's cotton crop. And in the state of Texas, of course, as everybody knows, we were very short, and Texas only produced 2.7 million bales. Excuse me. And of that, even though we still have yet to receive the actual county estimate, so I can't give you an exact number, but you can cut that number in half somewhere in the range of 1.3 million bales, and it looks like that's where we're going to land for the Plains cotton growers production area. Again, still waiting on those county estimates so that we can have the official numbers in place on that. But that's what we're looking at for the 23-24 crop.
And with the Lubbock area, the largest cotton-growing region of the U.S., how is Texas shaping up now?
This cotton crop is going in the ground across much of our area. We can look and see where we're at on the World Supply and Demand Report for May. And so whenever we look at the U.S. projections, which this is going to be very early for 23, you know, a lot of it has not even gone into the ground yet. And we know that we're a long way from having any of it in the module, at least in the United States. But what we currently are looking at in terms of estimates for the 24-25 cotton crop would be 16 million bales of production for the U.S., and that is based on a larger crop with slightly more planted acres and less abandonment projected for this year, mainly because we have better moisture conditions across much of the production regions this year. And so that's what we anticipate seeing is currently an early projection of a 16 million bale crop based on a 10.7 million planted acre estimate.
Those who produce the crop are important. Those who buy the crop are important. But those in the middle are vital. Brown talks about what happens if they don't have a crop.
I hear all the time that if we have another crop failure this year, we're going to see some major losses to the cotton industry, and that would mainly be the infrastructure that we are talking about. Of course, fortunately, crop producers do have crop insurance to fall back on. Outside of some very expensive insurance that is available on a limited basis for gins and infrastructure, they really don't have that same scenario to fall back on. So if we had another crop failure this year, and I'm going to bite my tongue, I'm going to say heaven forbid on that one, and we're certainly hoping for at least a decent crop this year, because it is to a stage now that it's very critical that we have some production out here.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So a lot of questions about this issue. And as a reminder, often what the trade believes and what actually is going to happen are two separate things.
Rich Nelson is chief strategist with McHenry, Illinois-based Allendale on HPAI and dairy.
One thing to keep in mind, of course, is we really have not hurt the nation's milk production on this discussion. So far, all the authorities still consider U.S. milk to be safe. No issue with that. And also, we know historically, consumers don't make lasting changes to demand on the meat side based on virus or disease scares. So, yes, it is 100% true. USDA actually increased their estimate of 2024 milk production on this report. Now, 227 billion pounds. Last month, they were just thinking 226.